Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yep, every week here at Sci-Fi, 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 we review a different science fiction or fantasy book, then give it a full discussion. Special shout out this week to all listeners named Scott.
Yay, Scott.
Yay, Scott. This week we are reviewing To Like the Lightning by Ada Palmer. This was chosen by me since it had gotten rave reviews all over the place, but I think it's safe to say we had a range of opinion here.
Yep.
We'll get to that in a second, but we begin, as we usually do, with the publisher's summary. This one goes a little bit more meta than the publisher's summary usually does, so just keep in mind that this all comes from the electronic book jacket. Here we go. Mycroft Canner is a convict. For his crimes, he is required, as is the custom of the 25th century, to wander the world being as useful as he can to all he meets. Carlisle Foster is a sensei, a spiritual counselor in a world which has outlawed the public practice of religion, but which also knows that the inner lives of humans cannot be wished away. The world into which Mycroft and Carlisle have been born is as strange to our 21st century eyes as ours would be to a native of the 1500s. It is a hard-won utopia built on technologically generated abundance, and also on complex and mandatory systems of labeling all public writing and speech. What seem to us normal gender distinctions are now distinctly taboo in most social situations. And most of the world's population is affiliated with globe-girdling clans of the like-minded, whose endless economic and cultural competition is carefully managed by central planners of inestimable subtlety. To us, it seems like a mad combination of heaven and hell. To them, it seems like normal life. And in this world, Mycroft and Carlisle have stumbled on the wild card that may destabilize the system. The boy Bridger, who can effortlessly make his wishes come true. Who can, it would seem, bring inanimate objects to life. So, that was the publisher's summary. You guys still here?
Barely.
Crickets.
As I mentioned before, we had a range of opinions on the book. What did you all think? Kevin?
Well, I'm not really sure how to
talk.
Conceptualize my response, actually. Let's just say there was one scene in the book that I was not completely frustrated, confused, or irritated with.
Just one?
Yes. And I realized halfway through, I'm like, there's something different that's happening now. Oh, wait. I actually enjoy this scene.
I believe I might have the same scene in mind.
It's a weird feeling that I'm having.
I don't understand.
I think it is called pleasure.
I've heard of this concept, but I don't know what it means.
Oh, that's...
Or lack of pain is probably more like
I believe we have taken damning with faint praise to an amazing new level.
I'm an expert, you know. I mean, probably if you listen to the podcast, I'm probably harsher on everything than I actually feel like in retrospect.
Except this time?
Maybe. I don't know. I'll have to say it's been a week and a half since I finished it, so... It's sort of gotten diffused a bit.
Yeah, this is one of our memory wipe podcasts. Some various minor events have kept us from recording for a few days, and so...
Yes, this is a post-election something.
This is our first post-event recording.
Yes.
So we're a little shaken up, perhaps, by the event.
So now that we are EV day two or whatever...
Everything is perfect now.
All hail the leader.
Anyway,
as I've said before.
As he said before, he's carefully offered to sell us out for apparently no price whatsoever.
Me first.
That's kind of, you know, along with Cthulhu, right?
Anyway,
they just hope
Barry,
they'll be killed
first.
Don't blame me. I voted for the asteroid.
Please.
Hail Bop or which one?
All of them.
Okay, but...
That would prove the existence of God,
reeling us back in, Barry, what did you think of the book?
Oh, is that what that wink was about?
No, that was... Anyway.
Hello. Yes.
This is our best podcast ever.
I am really having problems characterizing how I felt about this book. I think that the setting was interesting. I didn't particularly care for a lot of the word choices and some of the vehicles that were used in the book, dear reader. and possibly J.E.D.D. Mason
yes.
got a little old.
Some of that is artifact of it being read aloud as letters. I suspect that if somebody decided to narrate a book of your life with B-A-R-R-Y all the time.
I would just abbreviate it to B-A-R-F.
That wouldn't help much, but
barf,
sure.
Barf, barf, barf.
Anyway, yes. Great.
The book definitely picked up in the middle, I think, and then I don't know where the book went at the end. I think it just stopped, like it hit a wall or something.
There was a list of names that they found out. It yeah. was bad.
I mean, if you got, you know, Audible credits burning in your pocket, go for it. That's my review.
Part of it was there were a lot of like futuristic bits that in retrospect, I'm like, it seems like this should have been awesome, but it just wasn't.
Ah, we need to get you this in hard copy.
Yes. I normally like things about this is how the world could be, whether it's dystopic or not, just like, you know, this is a possible thing that could happen, right? And I usually like the gritty details of how things work. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about those pieces individually, you know, it's like, this should have been really interesting, even if I didn't like, you know, what they were describing, but it was just not for some reason.
Well, I mean, even if you take like one of the concepts of these sort of self-driving cars and, you know, a couple of Mentat-like people who basically control the entire car infrastructure was really neat. You know, they're all traveling around it,
right.
You know, basically super speeds and you could get around the planet in roughly 4 hours. I mean, that was really neat. You know, you take that part and you're like, hey, that, you know, that's cool. Right.
Right. I mean, I think part of this was they didn't convince me that the political system was quite as unstable as it seemed to have been implied.
I mean, I'm not even sure if it was the political system. It seemed like it was more like the...
Well, societal or whatever.
Yeah, it's like you know,
everything will collapse if someone finds out that someone did something with this thing.
Right, that couldn't possibly ever happen.
Yes, I know.
I mean, in retrospect, for me, it was sort of what would happen if like the afternoon entertainment shows became the leading powers, right? This is Entertainment Tonight and, you know, the TMZ or whatever.
Sure.
I don't know if that's a little far-fetched for Kevin or not, but...
It's like in our new overlord, Pat Sajak or whatever. Like.
Okay. Well, I think we should probably get back into that in the discussion section so we don't have to say, huh? The vague thing is better than that other vague thing.
Okay, so...
More vagueness.
Steve, you liked it, right?
Yes, I was the only one that was sort of cheering it on right until the end. Unfortunately, at the end, we did sort of hit a wall. I think that it's a great start to a series, which I haven't read the rest of or even the majority of yet because they're not out yet. And this is apparently the first volume in a 4-part series. And I knew that it was... you know, slated to be a series. Most books are these days, but I assumed that it would come to a conclusion, an ending of some kind.
And so the word stopped.
Yes, that's not the same as having a conclusion.
The audible track finally stopped blabbering at me.
I mean, when it says, this book will be continued in such and such.
Yeah, I was like, is this like, some melodrama on TV?
The Dukes of Hazzard will return.
Where the good old boys get out?
Yeah, exactly.
They never meant no harm.
Oh, boy. I mean, up till then, I loved the book. I really loved the linguistics of it. So this basically is the Neo-French Enlightenment in the future with super technology and really interesting discussions about philosophy and a lot of discussions about linguistics and some interesting stuff going on with the language because as rather bizarrely explicitly spelled out in the publisher's summary, there's a lot of gender-free language.
What did they think, Stephen?
What?
Yes, I didn't quite use that correctly probably, but they did use the word they quite often.
Yes.
As they...
I'll be referring to him or her as she or he during the course of this part of the book because of reasons.
Do you feel uncomfortable, Barry, that we've explicitly defined gender?
I'm not sure the word uncomfortable really applies, but I did wonder if Stephen could expand a bit on what Neo-French Enlightenment means.
Gentle listener.
Would you like me to be gentle with you, Kevin?
I don't think there's a good answer to that.
Like is... not the right term. But so what I mean by Neo-French Enlightenment is a lot of the style and the behind-the-scenes intrigue and ideas that are going on here are from the time of Voltaire. And I should point out that my knowledge of Voltaire largely comes from a report on Voltaire that I wrote when I was in high school.
So it's totally accurate.
It's totally accurate.
It's probably at least as good as Wikipedia.
Probably.
Straight out of the encyclopedia.
Exactly.
But didn't he do something about voltage or something?
Yeah, he invented the volt car.
Volt and air.
No. He was an Enlightenment writer, roughly contemporaneous with, say, Ben Franklin. He was a deist, so he was, you know, very forward-thinking for his day. His most famous novel was Candide, which was sort of this farce about this metaphysician, this philosopher that keeps on assuming that everything is going to be the best because this is the best of all possible worlds, and all of these horrible things keep happening to him. He was really the intellectual powerhouse of his day, and well, this is written by a professor of history that obviously has tremendous affection for Voltaire and is somewhat imagining a future that is very much in Voltaire's sway. I forget, there's a name that they call him, the Master or something like that, in this book.
From Doctor Who?
Well, that was helpful, thank you.
He was Voltaire.
We can't prove that he was not.
Yeah.
Also true.
We can save most of this for after the break, but it just, that part just did not work for me. It's like, it felt like...
See, you did the wrong reports in high school.
I mean, I appreciated on one level what the author was trying to do, but it felt like it was just like trying too hard to be intellectual, I guess.
Well, she's a history professor. She's not trying to be an intellectual. She is an intellectual.
No. Maybe it's just the
stop rubbing
style
my nose
or something.
In it.
It was reminding me of this book, Hyperion, that also had an abrupt ending.
Right.
It's basically because that felt like intellectual name dropping. Like right at the beginning of that book, there was this whole thing where he was like, ha ha, I'm listening to Wagner and what a great intellectual I am. And this wasn't that bad. That one just, I actually couldn't finish that book. Now, maybe I would have to if we were listening to it, but.
And to be fair, I gave that book way too much credit when it first came out because it ended, you know, right in the middle of something. And I thought, what a bold choice. What a brilliant move.
Just like AI.
And then it started up again.
Yes.
And it just turned out that, oh no, they didn't want to release it all in one because they figured they had a hit on their hands. So why not make people pay for it several times?
Yes. And
the funny thing is, I can remember actually buying that book when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was actually in the bargain bin at Safeway
well,
by my house. And I remember like looking at the cover and reading the back and going, I'm going to give this a shot since it's like, you know, $1.99.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate sort of the effort. Maybe it's just the writing style just doesn't mesh with me or something. I don't know. It just felt too much like, and here we all are intellectuals doing our governing in this like house of ill repute. And we're so edgy. And like, I was just like, oh, just shoot right now.
You know, now that you say that, it sort of made me think of a couple of movies where I watched recently where the main character listens to classical music. And it's, you know, very, very much in the beginning. And they only do it because they try and sort of class the character up a bit. You know,
now we got some class.
Because
this has been, sorry, Kevin was doing a character that only exists in our imagination.
Just like Kevin exists in ours.
Well, yes.
We're all sort of like a closed time loop where we all exist in each other's imagination.
Are you a flat circle?
Well, I think we all are flat circles.
Right. So anyway, yeah, I thought that this book was fantastic, but I am very annoyed that they have only given us the first quarter of it.
I'm not.
Yeah, I know.
You looked at me like you wanted me to say something.
There's want. And
there's different levels of wanting.
Yes. Anyway, it's time for us to take a break. Thank God. When we get back, we'll get to our spoiler section, for we are sci-fi.
Sci-fi?
Sci-fi.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Mark, welcome back, gentle listeners.
Dear readers.
Anyway, to start off, I'd like to do a brief plot summary. I'd like to.
Please
but
do.
I can't, since the plot defies description. Anyway.
Stuff happens, and then it ends abruptly.
Exactly.
Much like life.
Just. And it's the Ginglecast.
There's going to be a lot of editing tonight.
Or maybe not. Anyway, Mycroft Canner, our main character, is a horrible, horrible criminal. But he is these days a changed man, dedicated to helping others as much as possible. He has an important job these days. You see, there's a kid named Bridger that has magic powers. He can bring inanimate objects to life. He might be God. However, Mycroft also has other jobs to do. He has to find out who stole a list of influential people from a newspaper. He also has to do the bidding of J.E.D.D. Mason, another mysterious young man who may have strange powers of his own. Finally, he has to deal with the influence of a murderous lover of his. So, Kevin, you mentioned a scene that you did not hate.
Yes, that was the scene where it flashes back to him and his Bosch or his class of some kind, and they were discussing...
So, let me interject. In this future, they have decided that the standard family structure doesn't work very well, and so they've created all of these sort of little enclave groups where people can live together and feed off of each other creatively. So the equivalent of a Bosch is a family.
You mean like self-segregation?
Yes, it said at the beginning, it said a group of 4 to 20 people, and
yes,
they self-form... And they raise children and whatever.
Mm-hmm. So that's a Bosch. Anyway, you were saying.
Yes. So basically, there's a section where Mycroft and company were young and they were discussing basically what would you do to like save your Bosch or something like that, or maybe your hive. I can't remember which one it was.
Right.
And it's like, you know, oh, I would do anything, or I would do this and that. And, you know, it's like, oh, you know, it's kind of like the basic ethics discussion. Well, would you, you know, destroy another hive? Would you, you know, kill someone? What's the limit? Would you kill 10 people, 100 people, you know? And some people are like, oh, everybody, you know? And I don't even remember, but for me, that seemed to be the, and I don't know if this is where it's actually going, but it seemed to be the basis of the entire book, really. Where it's like, we find out later that Mycroft is like, you know, happily slaughtered 17 people or something like that. And it's like, why would he do that? And they kind of have hints of, oh, maybe he's a psychopath, maybe, you know, which is what everyone thinks, right?
Right.
But it seems to be that this flashback implies that he's actually doing it for the greater good, what he thinks is the greater good.
Right. Because what he did was very methodical. He wrote down a list of the most evil things, apparently, that one could do, and was following it. And there's a very strong suggestion that he actually did not commit all of the crimes associated with him.
Well, I think it's more than a strong suggestion, but right. Yes.
He has a lover named Saladin that apparently was part of his initial Bosch.
And that will answer one of our questions is the awkward sex scene, which it wasn't really an awkward sex scene, but it was like, it totally came out of nowhere as far as I could tell, unless I missed a, you know, beat there. And it was like, suddenly it's like, you know, Saladin shows up and there's, you know, nothing that graphic really, but it was like, wait, what, where did this come from? You know, I guess that was the first reveal, I think.
Right. We should probably explain the origin of the awkward sex scene question, actually. This came from a book that we read a long time ago that I think we all enjoyed called Red. And in Red, there was a scene that was taking place in a hospital, and it seemed very touching. And suddenly it was very touching in a very different way.
Yeah.
And I think all three of us were listening to it happily in the car, possibly with our spouses or whatever. And suddenly it transitions to...
porno.
And it was very short, but it was very jarring. You
know, yes.
Like, huh? Wait, what happened?
It was like a quick rut in the hospital room, you know?
I mean, it's like if you started with a Hallmark card and then the inside is like, chicka-bow-wow, and you're like, what?
On the front, puppies.
Those almost certainly exist.
Some sort of pop-up book with genitals, I don't know.
Which actually might describe some of this book as well. Anyway.
But yes, it's surprising the number of books that we read that have sort of this awkward sex scene.
Yes,
or
exactly.
Or protracted sex scenes or...
So when we say it's an awkward sex scene, we don't necessarily mean that we disapprove of the sex that's going on there. It's just that it sort of took us out because of it was kind of sudden or...
I don't think any of us are prudes.
Right. So there's definitely a Hannibal Will Graham thing going on between Mycroft Canner and his lover Saladin. And actually, one of the big things going on is that everyone thinks that Mycroft Canner has this amazing technology called the
Canner device.
Thank you. Canner device, which is...
Took me a long time to realize that that was supposed to be named after him, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That wasn't until the very end of the book that I was like, oh, right. Okay, I get it.
Exactly. And that's supposed to be a device that lets you switch your tracking information with somebody else, because everybody wears trackers.
Yeah, everybody's got like a little Bluetooth device that's like stuck in their ear.
Right. It's the natural evolution of the iPhone.
You couldn't just, you know, take it off.
Well, you can, but
yeah.
It's
yeah, I was being sarcastic.
Punishable.
And also they could tell, but yeah, right. That's another thing that I was listening to it again going, really, is their entire infrastructure going to crumble because they have one device that can like say, oh, that isn't really that person?
Right.
How else would we do billing?
Exactly.
So it turns out that Mycroft Canner actually never had the Canner device.
He only had the packaging.
He only had the packaging. He had basically faked it up to look like he had this amazing technological device. It seems that what he had was an accomplice that he had covered up for. And so that's how he was able to elude tracking systems, was by the amazing technology of having another guy do things.
Well, they did say that it seemed like he's able to mess with it, and I was a little unclear whether he was actually able to mess with the tracking at some point, or whether, like you said, it's just some other guy that was meddling.
Yeah, so this was, I think, somebody who was supposed to be one of his initial victims, or actually, no.
He was supposed to die in a car crash.
Right.
But he didn't.
Right. Anyway, so before we get to our usual questions again, Barry, did you have a standout scene you wanted to talk about?
So I think the part where the book kind of turned around for me was, I think, about the halfway mark where Mycroft starts to go into some of his crimes, or he starts to have like an exposition about all the things that he did.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty grisly.
Yes.
To me, that's the point where the book stopped kind of wandering around and going in circles around whatever the central plot point was supposed to be.
Right. Because suddenly now we know a little bit more about this guy that we've been, you know, hanging around with all this time.
I mean, you knew he was a criminal. They never would tell you up until that point what he did. And the fact
it
that he's
just
sort of,
bad.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that he's a sort of in charge of, you know, this little boy who has like this fantastic power to bring things to life, or actually will things into being, is really what it seems like to me. Because I guess there's like the, what was it, the box of things that the boy Bridger...
The no-no box.
The no-no box was like, pretty terrifying.
Don't activate the black hole!
Yeah.
He's don't. Like, I created a black hole and we put it in the box. I'm like, what?
Yeah, I don't think he ever actually brought it to life, but he sort of imagines that thing as a black hole, so that's why
so
he can't do that.
Don't do it, or bad stuff, maybe.
I get the feeling that his power sort of comes in two parts, right? It's one is creating the thing, and the second is sort of bringing it into actual being.
Right.
So he's got like these little army men, I guess, which I think is kind of cool. But, you know,
he found them in the trash at one point.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me a little bit of like Toy Story, right?
Exactly.
I mean, that part was pretty neat. I mean, to me in the book, it like didn't seem to really go anywhere.
Yeah, that's true. And that part at the very beginning, I was a little confused by it too. But,
well, there was also the, I think, unfortunate mistake of naming another character Sniper when all of the characters were named Pointer and...
Yeah. You know,
I can't remember. The General was the main guy, or was he the captain?
And there were some different colored army men, too. There was like a yellow one.
It was like no stand and, no gun or whatever and stuff like that. And I had that same confusion, too, of like, I just assumed he was one of an army men for a while. And then,
well, they did actually talk quite a bit about his name when it came in, so I wasn't that confused. But, you know, there was a certain amount of chatter going on our phones about who is this Sniper guy. Do we have an army man who seems to be invading every aspect of government?
I mean, yeah, it's like the point where they start talking about him as like a real child. And they're talking about like making like replicas of him as he's growing up, and like everybody has like a copy of it because it makes him feel better.
Right.
I'm like, this is really like super kind of creepy. And,
yeah, I didn't quite even get that part, but
yeah, but that wasn't the same as J.E.D.D. Mason, was it? I'm confused.
No, it's not J.E.D.D. Mason.
And Yeah, I can't even now remember who that was. I mean, I know they said his name a million times, but he was like the guy who held the sort of behind the scenes power or something.
Who, J.E.D.D. Mason?
Yeah.
Or was it J.E.D.D. Mason?
J.E.D.D. Mason.
Okay, thank you, dear reader.
Yes. So tell me more about J.E.D.D. Mason.
To explain a little bit.
About J.E.D.D. Mason?
Yes. Unfortunately, the narrator of the book, who I actually think did a fantastic job with a book that, you know, he seemed to be fluent in about 5 different languages, so he really had researched his languages fairly well. I forget who the narrator of this book was, but one thing that he did that I think was a bit of a mistake was he... there's
Jefferson Mays.
Jefferson Mays.
Good job, Jefferson.
There's a character who's known primarily by his initials, J.E.D.D. Mason.
Do we even know what those stand for?
Yes. At the end, it's actually revealed that the J stands for Jehovah.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
And he seems to be another super special boy like
Bridger.
Like Bridger. We see him be able to tell whether or not people are telling the truth at the end. It's not clear if he has other powers than that. And it turns out that Mycroft at least claims to work for him. And he lives in something that's a cross between a nunnery
and a whorehouse.
And a whorehouse, which is all, it's very, you know.
You know, absence is the most freakiest of perversions, and the most extreme of perversions.
Yeah. Oh, and there.
Self-denial.
Yes.
There is quite a bit of discussion of the Marquis de Sade.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, that did kind of come up a lot in my mind. I was like, wow, it's like, so if you take the Marquis de Sade, cross him with Dexter, and put him in charge of a boy who could do almost anything.
I mean, I guess, that's what I mean by it. It felt like they were trying too hard to, like, throw in a lot of, like, literary things.
I just think that they succeeded in throwing a bunch of literary things in there.
Probably for me, it was just the writing style. I don't mind when there's literary things in there, but it felt like name-dropping or something.
Well, that's kind of what literature is.
I know, but I don't... I can't explain it.
No, you
it's
are...
probably my problem,
I'm not
dear
saying
reader.
It's... I'm not saying it's your problem.
I sort of had a similar feeling. Like, I felt it was, like, trying too hard in some places. I mean, not the whole book, but in some places it was like, oh, God, you're going to just keep piling it in and ruin the soup.
And I was eating that stuff up because...
You finally got to use your English degree.
Pretty much. I mean, I don't have a problem with somebody that's really piling in all of the condiments in and, you know, creating a soup that's, you know, mostly just all the other stuff that you might actually enjoy. I think that it's fun to sort of read this intellectually challenging book that sort of makes me think about, you know, the Marquis de Sade and philosophy. And I sort of had a bit of regret there for saying that makes me think about the Marquis de Sade, but whatever the hell.
Pull out my copy.
Well, it's got my autographed copy. I've even still got his hand.
I've got a fingernail.
So, yeah, you guys would say a criticism, and I'd say, I totally agree, and yet I'm still loving this.
Yeah,
and I was piling along still on that to the guy.
I mean, I don't think anyone here is saying anyone else's opinion is wrong.
I am. No, I'm not.
Yeah, I mean, I could see how it would be awesome if it was clicking with you.
Like. Right. You're absolutely right. This is an extremely intellectual book. It sort of lives and dies if you... you know, if you think that the idea of an extremely elusive philosophical novel about the, you know, French Enlightenment in the far future where everybody has to refer to each other as they, if that's your idea of a great book, then this is the book for you. And if not, avoid it like the plague. Yeah,
shut your they hole.
So back to the whole 7-10 list or whatever.
Yes. That was the MacGuffin that started this, and the part that I was strangely annoyed that they didn't find out who stole this completely unimportant list by the end of it, even though, as far as I could tell, it had no particular relevance whatsoever.
I'm not even sure what the purpose of the 7-10 list is this point.
So the 7-10 list appeared to be, I went back and searched.
It's like a list of popular kids?
Pretty much. It's the, you know, the New York Times, am I philosophy or not?
And so there's the 7 biggest or only hives. I'm unsure about number.
But this was actually part of the problem was in the text version of the book, they actually give you the 7-10 list.
Oh, that would have been nice.
Right.
I think this is one of those audiobooks that if they had given you like a small PDF of,
right,
here's a couple of, you know, lists or figures or names that you're going to have, or words that we're going to use that are going to be deeply confusing for you.
Right.
Just hearing them.
Exactly.
Right. Like, because what's a Bosch? Is that like B-O-S-C-H? Is that a B-A-U-S-H?
Well, it's hieronymous Bosch, you know.
Is it there an umlaut in there? I mean,
that's... Right. It's, I believe, B-A-S-H, though I could be mistaken on that.
I think that's how you, yeah, you had written it down that way. But immediately I thought, is this like based on Hieronymus Bosch or something? It's like I thought of the Garden of Earthly Delights as the basis of, like,
you're just being intellectual
as the Bosch. Yeah, exactly. And that's, of course, I don't know why I would be thinking intellectual thoughts with the book, but
yeah. And they actually explain at some point that it's from the Japanese term.
Yeah, it's a shortening of a Japanese word which I don't remember, that is means, quote, more than family or something like that, or,
right.
Don't look at me.
I wasn't
okay. Try to look away. That was a visual gag.
It was hilarious, dear listener. Believe me, it was hilarious.
You may not know it yet, but it was.
Yes. So part of what has annoyed these two gentlemen is the fact that this is written in a style that's actually sort of French Enlightenment. And there is a tendency in those books for the narrator to directly address the reader and beg their forgiveness. And he actually talks about that in the beginning.
Look, if I wanted to break the fourth wall, I'd just go rewatch Deadpool.
That sounds like a really great idea. Let's do that right now.
Okay. I actually just watched it last week again.
Click. And then the podcast ends.
just as long as I don't take it up Main Street.
Speaking of not that, so we're back to our usual questions. Was there tea? I don't remember them drinking any, but I've got to admit that the book won me over fairly early on because one of the characters is described as having green socks that marked him as a tea enthusiast.
Ah, well, that explains everything now.
I completely missed this part of that book.
Yeah, I think that it's...
Steve just perked up, so...
Carlisle Foster, the sensei, was wearing green striped socks in the beginning that marked him as a tea enthusiast, because they all basically wear the equivalent of TGI Friday's bling all the time that sort of identifies the different things that they're into.
Which, the weird thing is, wasn't it someone, like, didn't people sort of have heads-up displays so they could look up information about people, or was that only certain people had that?
Well, no, those were the trackers, I think. So everybody basically had that.
Right. So I guess just as a random thought, why would they need to, you know, wear something if you could just look it up automatically based on your heads-up display?
Well, that would be absurd.
Yes. Anyway.
What if you took off your tracker and then you would not be able to tell?
So what I was saying earlier was I wasn't convinced that the 7-10 list was as critical to their society as it was saying. It's sort of like, you know, oh, I mean, and I can understand it from the point of view of, okay, you know, they're holding court. You know, someone in court does this major faux pas. Okay, now, you know, historically, yes, that person might be shunned or, you know, something bad could happen to their family in certain situations. But it sort of seemed like, okay, this person, whoever it was, stole the list that was supposedly a list of the cool kids. Right. And
then apparently somebody released a forged version of it.
Who was like the child of the leaders of something? I forget now.
I'm not entirely clear who stole the list. I don't think that they actually said who
well,
did
the forgery, I mean, was done by like their protege or something.
Actually, let's walk this back a little bit. So the list was normally done by a senior analyst at this newspaper, I guess.
Right.
You know, one of their veteran reporters. And he had quit for
Which reasons. We find out much later.
He had quit like the previous day.
Something like that, yeah.
And so they had basically given the job to an intern who was the, I guess, adoptive son of one of the major figures. And so the list that he produced was a little bit off, shall we say. And it was going to be released, and this was going to cause all kinds of mayhem in the world. A copy of it was stolen, and I don't think we ever really figure out the real significance of it. And this is actually one of the things that annoys me is they start up with, frankly, a very small mystery. Who stole an advanced copy of, you know, People Magazine's Sexiest People list.
Right. I'm pretty sure I'm on that list.
Yes, in crayon, only in your copy.
Is he a write-in vote?
I'm still on the list. I'd like to point that out.
This, in the same way that I helped write some of the original D&D books in my copy, I found like an old, my fourth grade copy of it. I had written myself by my name on there, and I was like, wow. The later on I realized that's because Gygax had listed, you know, the artifacts had a bunch of like, well, you decide what these powers would be, so I filled in some of those, and so I guess I felt justified to put my name on.
Basically,
I was slightly terrified you were going to say that they were in like Kevin's Amulet of Ambiguity.
I'm not sure what you mean.
I'm not sure either. Okay, so I think we've already discussed whether or not there was an awkward sex scene.
Well, yes, but we didn't go into the details where his ear was bitten off or bitten into, and that was, you know, his distinguishing characteristic. And he said, and this, dear reader, was where I got my first taste of human flesh.
You consider that a sex scene?
No, but that was part of that
scene.
Someone
found it pleasurable.
I don't think that's the game. But I did think of you first, Steve, where... Only in the context of Hannibal.
I'm searching around for possible weapons. All right. Okay. Moving very carefully.
There was also that sort of extended, you know, weird fondling scene where they're trying to figure out, you know, who's lying and who's not.
Oh, God, that was just painful.
Yes, that was
very, like, I mean, maybe I'm misinterpreting like some of the words or something, but...
No, I think you had it right.
It's sort of like, you know, high court, you know, fondling or something, you know. It's like, oh, I touched her thigh. I'm like, okay. Woo-hoo.
Yeah, no, basically what they were doing was taking kind of this... You know, Marquis de Sade concept of, you know, let's combine business with pleasure. Basically, there was a meeting of the leaders scene that that was enlivened by basically all of them, you know, fondling each other while this was going on. And two of the characters basically saying, can't concentrate, dragging themselves off to a side room to have sex while the meeting was going on.
They're like, we'll listen in on the intercom.
Yeah.
This is all in like, all on record too, which is...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's one of the scenes that kind of stood out as the seriously scenes, like with the whole like French court. It just felt just a little too childish for the leaders to like be acting that way.
And it wasn't a short scene either. I mean,
it kept going and going, and like, and I don't know. It was, yeah.
I mostly took it as comedy and was, you know, enjoying it like I was enjoying everything else. And it's just like, I think she's deliberately trying to challenge some norms. I'm not sure if she was saying that this was a good thing or a bad thing, though.
Right. Like you said, it's not like I was like, oh, it's, you know, my delicate sensibilities are being flustered. Ooh. I mean, it was just...
I'm titillated.
It was... I'm not convinced that this is an actual, you know, thing happening. It's a story I'm reading, but I'm not absorbed into the... into what's happening, I guess.
Like, this actually could explain some of our differences of opinion on how it made us feel. Was I wasn't trying to read much of this as a realistic narrative. I was sort of seeing it as a Rococo artifact.
I mean,
ooh, I got to use the word Rococo. I don't even know what it means.
You could check that off of your bucket list now.
I haven't heard that term since probably my art class in college.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it is a song title.
Yes,
anyway.
Actually, that's kind of what popped into head.
Yes. And given that, I would give the author credit if this whole thing was done as sort of a meta artifact, you know, meaning that if it was, you know, if this was supposed to be a construct of something that he was saying, so that's why it was sort of skewed in a certain way, because it was all filtered through his narrating it.
Mycroft,
right. So if that's the case, I could add, you know, 1 to 2 extra stars to my review of saying, okay, well, if you're actually spending the time to manipulate all events through his point of view, then... You know,
yeah, I'm not sure that I would necessarily go that far, but that's one reason that it didn't bother me, was I wasn't sort of sitting up every 5 minutes and saying, well, this isn't right. there's no children that can bang army men to life.
Well, right. Not that part. I'm perfectly willing to believe that.
I know,
could happen,
but I mean, there was a sort of that kind of raised my suspension of disbelief a little bit.
Right. Going back to the thing of where, you know, he supposedly slaughtered these people, which, well, we know he actually did, but, you know, the assumption was he was psychotic, right? Or something. And then they decided, I guess it was the king or something like that.
So, once again, we're talking about Mycroft.
Mycroft, right. Well, there's only one guy who's killed people, right? Or killed 17 people.
Directly.
I think that what has happened is Bridger is somehow involved in making him not an evil person anymore.
Oh, maybe that's what he meant by he literally couldn't do it, is that, you know,
right.
he just kind of touched him and said, you're good now.
Because he told Saladin, oh, now I'm doing it, because Mycroft told Saladin, don't let him touch you.
Yeah, I kept thinking, Salad? What? Like, yeah, he did say, don't let him touch you, but that's what makes me think of, like, okay.
But Bridger didn't even know what his crimes were,
sure.
Right?
No, I thought he did.
He had told him about them, but...
In the book, right? Not prior to that, though.
No.
I think he did, but he's changed now, or supposedly.
Right.
But then it sounds like maybe he's not. He's saying, you got to go kill the kid to Saladin, right?
Right. But I think that was sort of a backup plan of some kind. I'm not entirely sure why he was doing that.
So that's the part that kind of confused me was... Was he A, not actually reformed and he's just been undercover this whole time? B, he's trying to prevent something else bad happening to society or to the kid and he's saving him by having him killed? Or is it some other subtle plan, like he keeps talking about Providence and he's like, I'm testing Providence by saying, kill him now. Providence, you know, we will prove that he's a miracle by having Providence step in the way and prevent him from being killed.
So an incredibly convoluted plan occurs to me. So Mycroft is really worried as to what might happen if Bridger comes into bad influence, if Bridger is taken under control by the wrong person.
Ah, okay.
So he's told Saladin to go and kill him if necessary. Don't let him touch you. But... he is then hedging his bets because if Bridger does touch him, then now Saladin could be made into a good person. He could be manipulating Saladin, who doesn't obey orders, to actually go ahead and touch the boy.
Oh.
This might be some sort of overly clever three-part Batman type of plan where, okay, if he doesn't touch him, then he'll kill him, and then the danger's over. If he does touch him, now he's got an ally.
And what's the triple reverse psychology?
I'm Batman.
Oh, it is Batman.
Well, I don't know, but possibly.
The thing that occurred to me, but I don't know if it's actually the case, where the reason he, at that time, killed all these people was to... improve society or his hive in some way, that he's actually playing the long, long, long game.
Right. And actually, this comes into, at the end, we discover that the family that we've mostly completely glossed over, partially because I don't remember their name right now, the family that Bridger has been staying with, the Weeks Booth Bash or something like
that? Yes, that was driving me nuts, especially on 3x speed. Weeks Booth Bash, like, ah!
I may have that name wrong. This family, they are basically aircraft controller people.
Right, some of them.
They control something like 80% of the cars in the world, something like that.
Right. Everyone except the futurist, whatever that one was.
Yeah, there are different sort of groups that everybody belongs to. And
one of the people eradicating all diseases and, right. and building a base on the moon.
I think they're the Utopians.
Yeah, the Utopians, yeah, with their big goggles.
Sure, they're... kind of William Gibson type of people. They're
right.
I kind of like them. There was a group in Babylon 5 that was kind of like them called the Technomages, which is an unusually clunky name for Babylon 5, but you know, sort of using technology to do things that are like magic. But anyway, so it turns out that this group has been manipulating air car crashes to kill very specific people for the good of the world or to gain influence.
Right. Like, you know, the nth degree separation of somebody that you wouldn't ever connect as being a non-accent because they were like someone's cousin's sister's brother or something. And
right.
It's like the 35th order side effect is the one we really wanted.
Yes. By the way, there were a few parts of this book that I sort of accepted as dark humor. Like, for example, when somebody accuses Mycroft of being a mass murderer and he says, I was not a mass murderer. I faced everyone individually.
That actually was a pretty amusing segment.
Yeah, I guess And see, this is the frustrating thing about this book is like talking about it. I feel like, oh, I should have really liked all of this stuff. You know, all the concepts are awesome. And like,
read it again.
Yeah, I know.
And again.
Eventually, I was thinking, yeah, eventually I would like it if I listened to it this many times. But like the different files or whatever, right? The hives where it's like, you know, it felt like that was maybe underexplored. Like I was never even clear as to what was it, the cousins were. Like I never figured out what they were.
So that was
like a couple of them made, like the humanists, like what kind of made them this versus that, you know? And
so the cousins were the social joiners. They were the helpers, the sort of people that would come along and talk to you very earnestly about things. They weren't necessarily sensors, but a lot of them seemed to gravitate towards that profession. But they actually talked a lot about their history, that they started out as kind of a secret social network of sorts.
Yeah, there was probably things that happened in here that I just didn't connect and then got lost in the noise for me. But like I kind of
that
wanted...
That was, you know, relatively towards the end. And, you know, I wish they had been able to front load some of that.
Yeah,
but...
I mean, I could understand not wanting to kind of like, you know, do the 100% expository beginning. But sometimes that would have been helpful to... Because, yeah, I was like, humanists, okay, and they described that, which I can't remember now what it was.
But. The humanists were kind of the heroes. They were, actually, if you sort of think of a lot of this as the houses from Harry Potter, yeah. The humanists are House Gryffindor. They're the sort of like, I'm the hero, and I'm the sports guy, and I'm going to plunge ahead, and, you know, I have humanist boots that, you know, literally stamp my name into the ground so that I am stamping my name into history with every step. Which I thought were both silly and cool, which was kind of a lot of my thought of
was
this
that,
book.
Was that the one where the humanists had to have like a grand plan for their life, that kind of thing?
Pretty much, okay, yeah. Also, churches were basically outlawed because there had been so many religious wars, and so they instead had sensors, which are these people that will just earnestly talk to you. They're kind of like a mixture of a priest and a counselor and a psychologist, and they're all trained in philosophy, and so they'll talk to you about different, you know, psychological approaches and philosophical approaches throughout history.
Well, Siegfried.
Well, Roy.
Bob. Don't call me Bob.
Bobby.
What? My name is Robert.
Segue to the past.
To the future, you mean?
Yes.
To the future or to the past?
To the stars.
All right. Is there anything else we want to talk about, since I think we're running out of time?
You mean in terms of the book, right?
Just in terms of life.
Well, Steve, did you have a favorite scene?
There was just a silly scene where one of the lead investigators is trying to talk to one of the people in the family that has been crashing cars all over the place, and the guy takes F.U. and turns it into a song and sings it at him over and over again.
Oh, right.
Until he goes away.
I did actually clip that part from the audiobook.
That was... I like that more than I really should have.
F you.
I don't know why I'm bothering to censor ourselves. We do have the explicit tag, but...
Well, I think we try to avoid...
When not absolutely necessary.
Swearing when it's not germane to the conversation.
Because that's class. That's some class.
Turn on the classical music.
So that's it for this exciting episode. If you like this podcast or even feel neutral in a non-negative way, we'd appreciate a 5-star review on iTunes. You can also give us a like on our Facebook page where you can find out about upcoming episodes. Our theme song is Love Amplifier by Safe Word, available on Magnatune. And until next time, we are Sci-Fi.
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 Yeah.